Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Hashtag No Limits, and I am your host, Shelley Kino. Hashtag No Limits is about people whose society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, "We know who we are, but not who we will be." And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells and then reforms into the butterfly. As if that's not difficult enough, it then has to struggle while it's in the cocoon to get out of the cocoon in order for its wings to be strong enough to fly. While none of that can be easy, it does it and it comes out beautiful. And I believe that what our people that have had limits placed upon them by society go through is very similar. And so today I'm honored to have Destiny Huff. She is a fellow master IEP coach, and she's going to talk to us about her journey and what has gone on in her life to bring her here with us today. So Destiny, thank you for joining me. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to learn more about you because even though we're master IEP coaches, we've never met until like, what, 6 or 7 minutes ago before before the show started?
Right.
Yeah, so it's always exciting for me to learn what other backgrounds other master IEP coaches bring to the advocacy table. And I say advocacy because technically we're advocates, but that is not our approach to things. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that maybe as we get into things. So Destiny, tell me a little bit about you and your family.
So I am a military brat. My dad was in the military for over 27 years. And then my husband is in the military. So I am currently a military spouse and I have two amazing little boys and they're about to be 5 and 7. So they're 4 and 6.
Oh, wow. Oop, wrong banner. Sorry. There we go. I just realized I didn't have my tag up at the top. So 4 and 6, military. So my husband is former military and he spent 8 years in the military and I spent 7 with him. So that's awesome. I totally have a great deal of respect for all of our military members themselves, but also their families because we serve too. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't really think about that, especially the kids. So I'm happy to hear that you were a military brat and that you seemed positive about it, at least. So tell us about your story, the rest of your story.
So I am a licensed professional counselor. So I'm a mental health professional and I've always worked with kids. That was always my background, working with kids. I have adult clients as well, but my basis started out in kids. When my youngest, who's 4, when he was about 2, we kind of realized a speech delay, but we were doing a lot of comparing to his brother. And so we were like, oh, maybe not. And then when he turned about 3, we realized, yeah, there's a speech delay there. So we started speech services. So that kind of started my look into 504 IEP. Could he need these eventually? However, during that same time, his brother was having some struggles with perfectionism, black or white thinking. You know, I draw this picture. It doesn't look right. I need a whole new piece of paper. And so we just thought, okay, maybe, you know, and he had a little bit of anxiety because, again, I'm a mental health professional. So we thought maybe that's what's going on. You know, could he possibly have OCD? Because during COVID, he had the germ situation and he's got very specific about that. And he goes to kindergarten and we find out he's autistic.
Okay. So I have a question about that. You say he went to kindergarten and you found out he was autistic. So how did you find out does he just have autism within the school setting or does he now officially have the autism diagnosis? And the reason I ask is because earlier I put out a reel about, did you know that just because you get a medical diagnosis doesn't mean you'll get it in school and vice versa?
And that's perfect because that's actually what happened to us. So he was displaying these behaviors and we were really concerned. There's a lot of suspensions in kindergarten. Oh. Yeah. And so we reached out to a psychologist because we were like, we want to get him the best support that we can. The school actually started with we think there's ODD.
Oh, okay.
And which we know can be co-occurring. But as a mental health professional, I was like, no, that's not it. There's something we're missing. And so they did their special education evaluation. The psychologist did their assessments in combination with the school assessments for the special education evaluation. That's where the psychologist actually came with the diagnosis of autism.
Okay.
And then the medical professionals echoed the diagnosis of autism. The school did not, and they did an IEP for social emotional developmental delay.
Interesting. Okay, so one of the things that you said during that was ODD. So I just want to tell what that acronym stands for. That stands for Oppositional Defiant Disorder. We in education and in the mental health field and in, well, pretty much all actual occupations, we all have our little acronyms that we use. So if I catch those, I try to explain those to the audience just in case someone doesn't know what something means. And by the way, I believe today is today World Mental Health Day? Do you know?
I don't know.
I thought I saw a couple different things like that our town had made this Mental Health Awareness Day and that there was something else out there that I saw that I thought was celebrating that today was Mental Health Day. So and I run a mental health awareness walk. And, you know, so I thought, oh, well, I should know this. But I thought maybe you would know.
Too.
Yeah, and apparently if it is one of those days, it's one of those, you know, it's not a big Hallmark day. It's just on the calendar that way. So.
Right. Because I always go to, of course, you know, Mental Health Awareness Month, which falls into May. Like, that's when I really like all that. So,
right. Or maybe it's Mental Health Check-In Day or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So that's kind of what happened. And we even had to, when we got ready to get the results from the IEP and the evaluation, I even requested, you know, can you provide me with the eligibility requirements? Because I'm currently in the state of Georgia. This was in the state of Louisiana. And so I was like, can you provide me with the eligibility requirements? And I was like, per your eligibility requirements, he meets the criteria. It's impacting his education. He should have this on his paperwork and for his IEP. And they were like, no. So that journey and process, there was an attempt to put him out of school. Unfortunately, we had to go to the school board. All this while being a military spouse, my husband's training in the field on and off, and I'm raising a 3-year-old at the time. So that's what actually led me to become a master IEP coach, led me to become a special education parent advocate, just realizing that families need that support. And it was our first year as parents in the school system. So I have educators in my family. We put a lot of trust in that process and in that system. And I have friends that are educators and administrators, and seeing how they do it, I was like, okay, this will be okay. And afterwards I was like, this was not okay. And I don't think any family should ever go through what we went through.
Yeah. And it's so key what you said, because I think most people want to trust the education system, whether they have educators in their family or not, but especially if they have educators in their family, because you know your family educators and you know they're doing the right things. And so when you go into a school, that's what's expected. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen in a lot of cases, not in every case, but, you know, there are those situations. And I run into those quite a bit as a master IEP coach. And if you're helping other families, I'm sure that you have run into that quite a bit as a master IEP coach. And I guess technically there wouldn't be a need for us if everybody was doing everything right. So
true.
However, we are still there to, you know, make things better, because, you know, the IEP can always be written better. It's never going to be perfectly written. So you said they gave him, which I was kind of surprised by, the social emotional label versus like a developmental delay, because in a lot of states, before they turn the federal law is up to 9, but different states do it to different ages. Some are 7, some are 8. So what was it that really pushed them towards social emotional, and what was their reasons, I guess, for not really wanting to put the autism label on there?
So his diagnosis, and we know how we talk about how, you know, and I did a post on this on my page about autism and the levels, and how the levels are per the DSM-5, right? You know, that does not speak to the struggles or the child, and every child is unique. And I want to express that because I know a lot of times people get frustrated when they hear the levels. Right. So his autism diagnosis is level 1. And so he has some excellent vocabulary and communication. So it would be what was considered, now is to explain to people back years ago, the old days, quote unquote, high functioning, Asperger's, getting into that type of lane, which we no longer use those terms.
Right.
So as I say till today, because of his communication, there is a perception, there is a stereotype of what autism looks like. And so he had this big language, these big words, he seemed to have this understanding. And so I think they felt the communication piece of the autism diagnosis did not qualify for him. However, it qualified in his nonverbal, it qualified in his pragmatic skills, it qualified in his repetition. You know, there were different areas for which we were able to identify where it qualified at. So that's what led them to the developmental delay. And then the social emotional piece was the strong outbursts. So he would get so overwhelmed with the workload but he wouldn't communicate that. Mm-hmm. And he would only communicate it to me and his dad. So we can ask him, you know, what happened? And he'd be like, I got frustrated because I couldn't do the math. And that's what happened. But in the setting, that came out to hiding under his desk, or, you know, trying to avoid, or even that perfectionism came out where, and I speak about this a lot on my Instagram as well in posts, refusing to even start the task, because if I don't start, I can't fail. And so there's a difference between refusing to do a task to be defiant and refusing to do a task because of fear of failure.
Right. And is there a way, and I think I know the answer to this, that you can tell the difference as a teacher, that it's which one of those things it is?
So I was the best way, aside from asking the child after building that relationship communication, is data collection. When you're looking at in that classroom setting, and we even do this in the mental health profession, we get a lot of clients that come in and they're like, I know I have anxiety. And I'm like, okay, well, let's see. Let's do some tests. Let's do some assessments. Let's have some conversations. How has this been? And so initially when we would have our meetings, a big thing was, well, and just to give an example, and this actually happened, they're like, he refused to write the sentence because his classmate came up with the sentence and he wanted to come up with the sentence. Okay. I was like, okay. Which we know in accommodations and adjustments, well, if the end goal is to write the sentence, we can provide him with the ability to write a sentence and maybe not that sentence, right? If we're looking at the child, but that's not the point. The point was, okay, he's refusing to do it. So I was like, okay, buddy, what's going on? Did you want to make up the sentence? Did you want to choose the sentence? And he was like, no. He was like, I've been struggling with writing this letter, and this letter was in the sentence multiple times.
Oh, okay. I love that so much, because I do trainings to teachers, and I do one called Understanding Behavior Lessons for a Lifetime. And I talk about the fact that we often think we know why a behavior is happening, but we're wrong more often than we're right. And that is a perfect example of, you know, oh, well, it was just because his friend came up with a sentence and he wanted to, and that's why he's not doing it. Mm-hmm. But the reality was, what you just said about the different letter, or the letter being in there multiple times.
And I've always come from behavior with a being in mental health, and I'm working with small children down to 3 years old, and helping, you know, childcare providers as well as in the school setting about behaviors. I'm a big proponent of what is the cause of the behavior, because that's really what you're trying to address. And one of my triggers is when someone says, there's no trigger.
I always say,
even if it is that they genuinely don't want to, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to do this. Okay. I always say, why? Because the why matters. I don't want to do this because it's boring. Okay. What about it is boring? I don't want to do this because it's difficult. I don't want to do this because I don't like writing. Okay. That's still a reason. That still gives you something to look at. I don't want to clean up because I don't like cleaning up.
Right.
I don't like cleaning up either. So right. I think a lot of times, and I say this, parents, professionals, educators, everyone gets wrapped up in not liking the why, instead of getting wrapped up in solving the why. I don't have to like that he doesn't want to clean up.
Right.
Right. But I do need to figure out why and a compromise or a solution to that. And then that's what goes back to the goal. That's what you're tackling. That's what you're teaching.
Yeah. Oh man. I agree with that 100%. I love that. I love it when I get people who have the same philosophy of behaviors as I do, because, it's so fun to talk about it. I think, I know there's probably people going, it's not fun to talk about behaviors. But I really do. I feel like a private investigator, a little bit when we start talking about behaviors in kids. And I do, I also become a 2-year-old, I say, maybe with I don't want to call it ADHD, but, you know, where I'm just like, why? Well, why? You know, and you did it. I mean, you said, okay, well, you don't want to do this. Why don't you want to do this? Well, I don't like writing. Well, why don't you like writing? Well, because of this or because of this. Okay, then I can work with this and this, you know, or why don't you like to clean up? Well, because it's gross or it's, you know, it's boring or whatever, you know, and then you can find these things out, but you have to take the time to exactly what you said. You put your own desires aside and your own assumptions aside,
right?
And you keep asking those questions and you keep investigating, because some kids were saying, oh, ask these questions. Some kids can't answer or they don't know. Well, I don't know why I don't want to do it. I just don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. But if you have that relationship, if you're doing data collection, if you're paying attention,
right,
and you're taking notes about what you're paying attention to, so that you can look back at those notes and go, oh, you know what? On this day, he did this. And that's similar to what's going on right now. And then you can start connecting dots as well.
Right.
But if you just observe, is it a pet peeve of yours? This is a huge pet peeve of mine. When I see on an IEP that they're just going to observe as the evaluation criteria, not an observation log. They're just going to observe. It just sends me up a wall. Does that bother you too?
Yes, because when you're just observing, then it is up to your interpretation and you're not providing information. And so if you're observing and you're documenting, then I should be able to come in and observe and document. And we should be able to compare notes and say, oh, well, you saw this here, but I saw this here. And in the mental health field, we have a saying, if you didn't document, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a big proponent of that. And so, you know, you have to take the time to learn your students. And that's why I always say everything is individualized. Everything is different. An example I give to my mental health clients to reference is, I go, if you have a sibling, if you sat down with them today and run through your childhood, it's very different. Mm-hmm. Grew up in the same house, the same parents, and that's what I'm referring to. You grew up with the same caregivers, same guardians, and you will see that you had two very different childhoods. Why do we not look at children that way?
Mm-hmm.
And then another one of mine, a big one for me, is aggressive behavior. I'm like, if you're an adult and you have gotten so frustrated that you have never wanted to throw something, then kudos to you.
Right.
Because I have. And I say, but the difference, right? I know that's not socially acceptable. I know that will alienate others. I know those things. So when you ask a child why they shouldn't do something or why they're doing something or why they don't want to do something and they say they don't know, that means that you need to teach them about that. If I can't tell you what I'm feeling, I need to learn about emotions.
Right.
If I can't tell you what calms me, then that means that I don't have coping skills.
Yes. Yes. And those are things that we can write into the IEP. Those are things that we need to be putting into the IEP for those kids, because for whatever reason, no matter how young or how old they are, they haven't picked it up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some kids will kind of naturally, I think, and maybe that's wrong. But you know, they'll pick things up along the way of how to self-soothe or how to cope mm-hmm. with different things. But other kids don't. And so we have to teach those skills. Another pet peeve of mine is on behavior intervention plans here in Illinois. And I think it's, again, I think it goes back to the federal law that you can write whether it's a skill deficit or a performance deficit. And to me, I think everything should be written as a skill deficit, even if you're really sure it's a performance deficit, because the mindset is different. If you think it's a skill deficit, then there's something that we need to work on with the child. If you think it's a performance deficit, then you're putting all the responsibility on the child and you're just saying, well, they can do it. They're just choosing not to. And therefore, there's nothing I'm going to do to help them.
Oh, and Shelly, that is a pet peeve for me when they're like, they could, they just choose not to. And I'm mm-hmm. like, when you have, and I, you know, I'll reference my son, in his kindergarten days, he would 3 days later say like, I wish I had had a better day on that day.
Right.
Those things stuck with him. And so to make that assumption that they're just choosing not to, you know, I'm like, I don't know about you, but I don't choose knowing I need to get somewhere fast and end up speeding. I don't choose to like speed and know I'm going to get a ticket. Like, I'm not thinking at the time. I'm thinking I need to get to where I'm going so I'm not late. And then when I get a ticket, it's like, okay, there is the consequence of my own action, right? But I'm a full adult. I'm grown. Yes. I have this understanding. And I think when we talk about children, we forget about that developmental part, about their brain, about how the older we get, they're actually pushing the age back, right? Like it was like 18, their brain's fully developed. And it's like 21, their brain's fully, you know? So even moving the term for what an adult is, but we're expecting a six-year-old to sit for 6 hours, right? Because they don't move classes like they do in middle school and high school. So, but we're expecting them to sit that long and do work in between lunch and let's say their specials. And it's like,
that's spot on, in my opinion, at least.
Right.
I don't know how many people agree with us, but, you know, at least you and I agree with one another.
Right.
So we kind of veered off of talking about your son. I apologize for that. So let's get back to talking about your son. So we've heard why they went with the SEL instead of autism and the developmental delay. So he's been in kindergarten now, and I'm presuming with those suspensions that he does have a behavior intervention plan in place. Is that a correct assumption or am I wrong?
That's correct.
Okay. So talk about that. Talk about that functional behavioral assessment and then how that turned into the behavior intervention plan. Because I don't think I've ever really had anyone who's been through that process and who can understand it, not just from a parent's perspective, but from a mental health perspective as well.
So when he got ready to start school, I actually had a conversation with his teacher prior to school, I was like, hey, we got these perfectionism, you know, this perfectionism is black or white thinking. I gave the whole gambit. I wanted to meet the school counselor. I wanted to meet the military family life counselor. Mm-hmm. I was like, I want everyone. You got a school social worker? I want everyone there because I want to set him up for success. And so that did not happen. I had to request the meeting more than once. Mm. And I finally got the meeting because he had a really rough day. And they were like, oh, maybe we should be tracking or figuring out what's going on. From the beginning, I was like, can we get a behavior plan? He had came out of the child development centers. He had had a kind of light behavior plan during that time for some accommodations for coping skills and things like that, you know, in that area. And I was just like, I think that's beneficial. I was like, because we're helping him develop tools, that self-regulation, the school counselor can work with him on that, all those things. Oh, we don't need one. Okay. Fast forward, we have about two more meetings, several phone calls, two suspensions, and now we're doing a behavior plan.
Okay.
So the behavior plan literally coincided with the special education evaluation. And during the meeting, what was interesting was all parties were not on the same page.
Oh.
I had done some research at that point, not a master IP coach yet, not doing any of that yet, but I had done some research and I was like, hey, can he have these tools, a timer, task breaks, you know, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, well, that'll mess with the data collection. School psychologist goes, no, he can have those.
Mm-hmm.
See a look exchanged, and I'm like, okay.
You know, but I love that because so often one party doesn't necessarily speak up if they disagree with the other party, especially if they're coworkers,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I'm really happy to hear that that happened in that meeting. We're like, no, we can work with that.
And I think why it happened too is because the psychologist was for the district and the administrator was for the school.
Uh-huh.
And so the psychologist was the one doing the behavior intervention plan. And so she was like, no, we can do that. But this was also at a point where she had observed him and she had saw that anxiety we were speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
And how he was struggling with writing or doing the expressive communication because of fear of saying the sound wrong. So she had already noted these things. Whereas at this point, we're halfway in the school year. So right. The school is already like defiance behavior issue was what we were battling. So I think that made the difference too. And we also had his psychologist look over the behavior plan. And then she was like, oh, this is very punitive and not very strengths and support based. Yes. So I think that there was a lot of hands in the pot, but helpfully so, to where it was like, let's try and at least get this right. And then it was like, mom's a mental health professional. So they would suggest things. And I'm like, I would never have a 6-year-old do that. And they were like, oh, okay.
Well, that's good. And, you know, it's another key point that you just brought up. I see way too often that behavior intervention plans are punitive. And their intention, according to, again, Illinois and how we do it here, and I believe, again, that this is supposed to be across the country, mm-hmm. that it's not about changing the child. It's about the things that the adults are going to do differently, different ways that they're going to respond to situations, different, my brain just went blank, different ways that they're, you know, like if they're going to use manipulatives or if they're going to different strategies, you know, it's not about, oh, well, you know, if the child doesn't comply, then they're going to go into timeout or they're going to go, you know, to this. And that's how I see most of them. is they are very punitive. So I want any of the listeners to understand that if your child has a behavior intervention plan or a BIP, look at it and make sure that it's supposed to be positive. I do know that the federal law talks about that it has to be, you know, a positive behavior intervention approach. And so if it's all about the fact that, you know, well, if your child doesn't do the behavior that it's working on, then there are going to be consequences that are negative, then you need to contact me. You need to contact Destiny, because we're going to help you get that turned around and written in the more positive way.
Yes. And age appropriate. One of the things that he had, this is kindergarten, he's learning how to write. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of the things that he had was he would write an apology letter for said behavior. And we know the intent was for him to take responsibility for his actions. And I was like, I know we're halfway in the year. Maybe you haven't seen my child write. So I'm like, how's he writing an apology letter? So I replaced it with drawing a picture. And it became more of a, not a punitive, like, you did this bad thing, so you owe them an apology. So what I did was, too, I also said, I'm replacing the language. I'm not saying you write this, you draw this picture because you did A, B, C, D, and E. How do you think today went? What do you think happened today? How do you feel about what happened today? How would that make you feel? And again, we're talking about if the child is verbal and has language that you can help them with, right?
Right.
Just make it unique to the child. And he was able to verbalize, you know, like, I, you know, flip my desk over. You know?
Like, right.
Shouldn't have done that. And so, and he's like, and I feel like that made Miss Such and Such sad. And so he drew her, his favorite thing is Pokemon. Drew her a Pokemon picture. And I wrote out for him, and then he copied to his teacher, and then he wrote his name because at the time that's what he could write. He mm-hmm. could write, but he wasn't going to write a sentence, a whole apology. And I wasn't going right. to, I want, it's teaching them that independence and also helping them understand what they're taking responsibility for. And I think
exactly.
we miss out on a lot of that because I can tell you, you did A, B, C, D, and E. But what do you think you did? And as he went on, he could say, like, I did this, this, and this because I was this, this, and this, and I shouldn't have done right. this, this, and this.
Right, right.
But he learned that through conversation, interaction, communication. And when they finally got their PBIS person in, what she
positive was, behavior intervention support person.
That's right. Positive behavior intervention support person. They've been waiting all year and they finally got her in. And what she would do was at the end of the day, when they would go through his behavior log, he received like a sticker for each portion of the day, each section. Mm-hmm. They would go through and she would review with him his day. And they would talk about the positives and what she thought was positive, what he thought was positive, and where he could improve and do better. And then we would echo that at home. That is the intent of a behavior plan, a behavior log, which, by the way, I created his behavior log. Because there was a lot of like, we don't know, and back and forth. And I'm like, I'm a mental health professional. I help people write behavior plans in development centers and stuff like that and in schools. So I made it and created it. It was Pokemon based. Yep. And so, but we talked about it and I'm like, that's how you hold them accountable. That's how you don't remove things like recess, but right. you still hold them accountable and have conversations to where they have understanding.
Yeah. And I love that, you know, you were able to get the team to understand the individualness of your child and, you know, find those things that are going to have some connection to him. The Pokemon behavior chart, that's going to have more of a connection. And, you know, he's going to want to interact with that a little bit more than if it's just a nothing, you know, no graphics, nothing that's connected to something that he is interested in. The other thing that you said that I thought was really good is, you know, so often we make kids apologize you know, well, you did this, and so you have to apologize. And they'll say, I'm sorry. And I have really upset parents over the years multiple times because they will bring their child back to me, you know, oh, he wants to tell you or she wants to tell you they're sorry, Mrs. Kino, or, you know, and I'll say, you know, they'll say, I'm sorry. And I'll say, okay, what are you sorry for? And they just look at me and then they look up at their parent like, I didn't know there was going to be a quiz. Like, I don't know what I'm sorry for.
Right.
If you don't know what you're sorry for, then how are you going to really, truly accept responsibility for it and know that, oh, this is an unwanted behavior towards this person or towards society, and then learn about why it's an unwanted behavior and then figure out acceptable ways or other ways to express yourself. And so, yeah, I had lots of parents look at me and they're like, but I made him apologize. And I'm like, but he doesn't know why. What's the point?
And if you, and I think the big thing too is finding out, like, my 4-year-old like popped his brother in the back and I was like, hey man, I was like, don't you think you should say sorry? And he was like, no, because he was my toy and I didn't like it. And a lot of parents take that as like, oh, and I was like, teachable moment. I was like, mm-hmm. Okay, so you've kicked his toys before.
Mm-hmm.
Liked it? He was like, no. And I was like, did he hit you in the back? He was like, no. I said, what did he do? And he's like, he said he didn't like it. And then he told on me. I was like, okay. I was like, so what could you do? I don't like it, brother.
Right.
Like, but that's why you do that, because it's not just they need to understand why they're apologizing, but you need to understand why they're not.
Right. Exactly.
Because yeah. They don't know. There's sometimes it's like, you did this thing to me and I don't like it. And so that's why I'm not apologizing. I meant what I did. And so it's like, what's the replacement behavior
yes. For
what they did?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not a mental health professional, but I play one sometimes.
And, we all do.
And I did it a lot with my daughter when she was growing up. And I did a lot of that. Like, well, why did you do that? Or why didn't you like that? Well, you know, and then, like you said, just asking those questions and saying, okay, now put yourself in this person's shoes. And, you know, this might be what they're going through. And how did it feel when you went through it? You know, and yeah, she was not happy with me a lot of times.
Yeah. And my 4-year-old, he is like all the, so we did a lot of social emotional with my 6-year-old when he was about 3 was when we started seeing some behaviors. And so my 4-year-old got it when he was 1 because they're 2 years apart. Mm-hmm. And we see that very strongly. He will tell you, like, you hurt my feelings because I asked you to look at this.
Right.
And so he's very vocal. And so, but I love that because, like the example I gave you, that's him. Like, he'll say, right. Like, oh no, I did this because of this. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, but no, like, you're
right. Supposed
to do that. But you don't have that opportunity if you don't teach them. And I think just one thing I wanted to make sure I said on here was, we talk about emotional regulation in the school setting. A lot of parents and a lot of educators start wanting to implement or teach it when they're seeing it's not there. And it should start younger. And I say this all the time. They have emotion books for babies where they can just feel it and you can just talk about it. And so teach them young about the emotional regulation, where they get upset, how they get upset, why they get upset, and acknowledge that you're upset. And a lot of parents, I know our generation grew up with, like, well, we don't want to put our worries and fears and concerns on our kids. And that's not what I'm saying. Don't talk about things that are grown up and adult. But if I look tired and my child says, like, mommy, are you tired? I am tired. Or right. I am sad. Or, you know, I'm having a good day. I am very happy. Mm-hmm. Express that to them so that they know, like, sometimes you have rough days too. But you talk about it and you overcome it. And that's how you help them develop those skills. You don't have to wait until they're 4, 5, 6. You can start when they're a baby and they'll eventually pick it up and it becomes ingrained in them.
Yeah. And if your child is older than that, as we said earlier, there isn't an age where it's too late, you know? So if you haven't done this with your child or your students, then start now. I was having a conversation with my mom the other day, and we were talking about a situation that had happened. And I said, well, you know, they should. And then I paused and then I started laughing, and she's like, what are you laughing about? And I said, well, because I'm always talking in my behavior trainings about who decides what is the right age that someone should do something. And I said, and here I am using that, you know, because we don't all grow up in the same house. We don't all have the same standards by which we're living. We don't all have the same abilities to teach certain things and or the knowledge to know that we need to teach those things. And so when we're in school settings and the educators are saying, well, by now or by this age or, you know, by this grade, they should know how or they should know this. Who determined the should?
Right. And fun fact, when you Google, like if you Google, you know, how many words should my child be saying or how many, there are so many variations. And if you look at it, you know, you can get a good average where there's kind of an agreement, like it needs to be at least above a certain number, but there's so many variations and there's so many differences. And it's just like, so what's the right answer?
Yeah, exactly. Most everything that you look up, it'll be a range. You know, it's, oh, well, you know, from this to this or from this age to this age, they're developing these skills. And like one of the things that I've started talking about a lot in the last year is executive functioning skills. And as you mentioned before, you know, we are now saying that people's minds are not fully developed until their middle 20s. Mm-hmm. And they break down the executive functioning skills. And I show that when I do these presentations. I'm like, we're asking kids to do things that their mind is really not ready for. And here's the chart and here's the age that, you know, they might be ready for it. But even if at this age, they might not, because not everybody gains that executive functioning skill at the same level at the same time as somebody else. Because again, it's a range. Mm-hmm. There's so much I do pick on education because outside of parenthood, or outside of being at home with your parents, school is where you spend the majority of your childhood. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we are co-parenting these children and, you know, we need to know this as educators. We need to put into practice all of the things that we've learned at all of these different professional developments that we've gone to. And then that leads me down the whole rabbit hole of our universities need to start training us better to begin with. But that's a whole nother subject. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, the development of the brain and the skills and everything is just, we're learning so much all the time. Mm-hmm. And we don't always apply it the way that we should, but we expect our students to.
Right. And even thinking about, and again, I'm not in education, I'm in mental health, and I became an advocate based on my child's special education journey and that dynamic. And I have educators in my family, though, in the school setting and in the child development setting. Think about all of the education programs and the spark of certifications for autism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we progress, as we know more, as we learn more, we're seeing increases in diagnosis. You know, we're seeing, you know, girls that were not diagnosed that are becoming adults that have autism or have ADHD. And, you know, my son, a lot of people were, you know, struggled to initially understand the diagnosis, you know, and even me and my husband, it wasn't so much to understand it. We were just like, huh. And then we could use assessment tools. And we're feeling, you know, I'm like, oh, anxiety, maybe some OCD, you know, the weight, the perfectionism. And I literally, Shelly, filled out my first initial parent assessment from his psychologist. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's autism. Because I'm a mental health professional, so I know how to score it, too.
Right,
so
right.
I actually was like, fill out, score. Oh. Which, you know, you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
But then you get all of the other assessment tools and data, and it was like, there it is. And so he was diagnosed considerably late, right? Because he was diagnosed at 5. And a lot of times it's seen before that, you know. So, you know, that's why I say that. So, you know, it's just one of those things where it's just like, as we know more, I think we just have to catch up. You know more, you know better, do better. And I had a supervisor once that said, the day that I stop attending trainings and think that I know everything in mental health is the day that I need to retire. And I think that that applies to mental health. It applies to education. When you're working with children, you can't ever stop learning. You can't ever stop growing. And if you don't know, ask. It's okay. Yes. And I say that as a mental health professional who was like, what is going on with my kid and why can't I help him? And I had to go and ask for help and ask my educator friends and my friends that do behavior interventions and that are licensed clinical social workers and educators. And I had to ask them questions and they were just like, you're not getting the support to help him. You're doing all you can, but you're not getting that support. And I say that because he's in his first grade year now. And so I want other parents to know, we are in a different state. We are in a different school. And his IEP team is phenomenal. And they communicate and they work with us. And I can send them a parent concern letter and say, hey, I'm requesting data. You know, I would like to look at this data at, and my preference was at the meeting. I had already had the IEP draft and we were just making amendments. And I was like, I would like to look at this data at the meeting. We had already discussed this change in schedule. We had discussed the behaviors. We had already did all that. I just want to physically see the data at the meeting. Data was there. School psychologist is reviewing the data, showing me the graphs. His general education teacher is going through every academic point, letting me know he's on track here, he's on track there, he's on track here. We have no academic concerns. His special education teacher is justifying the schedule change. And his IEP is being changed to say autism, because that is what is impacting. Now that they've gathered his data, because again, we're military, so we moved, so they had to do their data gathering while implementing, which is something for military families, if you don't know, they have to follow the IEP your child currently has. Don't let them tell you they have to collect their own data. But they collect their own data during that process to determine if they agree, if they want to change his category of eligibility, if they want to adjust his behavior intervention plan, BIP. and so based on his, they feel that autism is the category it should be under. That is what's impacting his education. And we talked about that, looked at the data and things like that. So I did want to add that as a success story and saying, like, yes, I had both sides of the coin, and not all teams are created equal, and not all struggles are the same, and not all of them last.
Yeah. And I think that's a very good point that you brought up. So for anybody who is listening, there's a couple things that you said in there that I want to bring out, is the fact that IEPs are living documents. They can be changed. The schools have to look at them at least once a year, but that doesn't mean you all can't look at them more often. As a parent, if you want to call a meeting, you know, or you want to have a quarterly meeting and you want to schedule those at the beginning of the year, I actually have a client that we do that with. We meet every quarter with the team and we just discuss how things are going. Do we need to change anything? Does anything need to be tweaked? You can absolutely do that as the parent, but even as an educator, if you think the IEP isn't working for a particular student, you can call the meeting. The fact that, yeah, when you move, whether you're military family or not, but yes, we know military families, you know, move quite a bit, but we have all these families that are migratory, for various different reasons. Mm-hmm. And yes, if your child had an IEP at the previous district that you were in, then the new school has to follow that, has to provide a comparable IEP services, because they may not be able to do exactly what was happening at the previous school, because as you said, you know, not all schools are created equal, not all teams are created equal. But yeah, they're not going to just say, well, no, we're not going to give them an IEP, or we're not going to give them any of the services in their IEP until we do their own data. That is absolutely illegal, absolutely wrong. There are new things coming out from the Office of Special Education at the federal level all the time. In fact, they just, I think it was November of last year, put out a letter talking about this exact thing. Like if you move in the middle of an evaluation, and they address that, and they address, you know, exactly what we just talked about. So again, you know, if you're a family who's moving, whether it's a first time move or you've moved, you know, three times in the last 5 years, reach out to myself, reach out to Destiny, and we can most definitely help you make sure that your child is getting what they're supposed to be getting at that new location. And Destiny being in the military right now has even more current knowledge. My knowledge is 25 years old now, of, you know, what the military offers, but the military does do a great job of offering those supports for their personnel and their personnel's dependents. So make sure that, you know, you're reaching out, and if, you know, if there isn't somebody on your base that's able to give you what you need, as far as the IEP situation with your child's school, you have Destiny, you have myself, please reach out to one of us. And speaking of how to reach out to Destiny, her website is destinyhuffconsulting.com. And that's Destiny, D-E-S-T-I-N-Y, Huff, H-U-F-F, as in Frank, Frank, consulting.com. And then she's on Instagram as destinyhuff_IEP_advocate. So you want to make sure that you are reaching out to her or to myself. I think anybody who listens knows how to find me. But if you don't, you can reach out to me at shellykino.com. Or you can reach out to me, shelly@shellykino.com. That's my email address. So please don't go through this process thinking you're all alone, because not only are there Destiny and myself, but there are now, I think, thousands of master IEP coaches. And we definitely, as I said, yes, we're advocates technically, but our approach is very collaborative. And so, you know, we're not going to come in and we can work with both schools. I work with schools probably more now than I actually do individual families. But that's not to say I only want to work with schools. I definitely want to work with those individual families. It's just so happened that I'm, you know, working more with schools, but it's kind of ebbed and flowed for me. So Destiny, do you also work with schools or do you just want to work with families?
Yeah, I also work with schools because it is a collaborative process. And so even with my own son's IEP, I actually had his goals restructured and broken down because, again, prior to being a parent advocate, mental health, I trained on SMART goals. And so I was like, okay, now we just implement the education aspect and, you know, what's realistic in a school setting and got it. So I actually took his goals and restructured them. And my son is actually in a DODEA school, which is a Department of Defense Education Act school. And they are military affiliated and located on some bases, not all bases overseas. That families can go to, but not all bases stateside have a DODEA school on their base. And so if you've ever had an IEP with them, you know that they are very structured and they have a specific protocol that goes for all of DODEA. So all of their DODEA schools use the same protocol, regardless of the state location, because again, they're considered federal. And so when I first mentioned the goals, they were like, his special education teacher was kind of like, she's like, I was talking to the school psychologist because they have a specific format. And I was like, okay, but I knew it would work because it's the same as with other schools. And when you're looking at goals, it's just to be smart. So there's certain things it has to include. And that was what his included. And it just broke that down. And so they completely reformatted and structured all of his goals. And we broke up those ones that have like, you know, three things we want him to accomplish into individual ones, because I said, well, I think we're getting here, but I think we have a lot of work to do to get here. So I want there to be this sense of accomplishment for him and a sense of progress as we work with him collaboratively. So, so I've worked at the school in that sense. And then again, on the therapist side of things, I have worked with the school and then with the child development center. So when you talk about those early intervention plans, I have worked, collaborated with the school to help prepare the child to transfer into the school setting when there's behaviors and doing behavior plans and goals and things like that. So.
Awesome. That's so good. So cool. I don't know. I was trying to throw two words together there and it came out weird.
All the time.
Yeah. Well, Destiny, we have about 4 or 5 minutes, and I want to make sure that you have expressed everything that you wanted to express. I know you said that earlier. You wanted to really make sure you mentioned emotional regulation. Is there anything else that you haven't said yet that you definitely wanted to get across or have an opportunity to speak about today?
All I wanted to say is that, again, with Master IP coaches, you know, we all have kind of like our niche and things like that. And, you know, my niche is really and truly that military side, you know, but I have helped, again, others navigate it that are civilian and behavior intervention plans. And so I think that, you know, there is help, there is support. And the thing that I've learned with the Master IP Coach Network myself is that even if something is not your area, you know, I can direct you into someone whose area it is. Like, I won't presume to be able to really assist with the IP for dysgraphia, but I can direct you to somebody that could. But I, you know, there's help, like Shelly said, Shelly, myself, others, you know, and we've gone through this process. We know, you know, I know the pain, I know the struggle. I know balancing being the professional and the personal, and having that responsibility. So just reach out and don't ever, ever feel like you have to do it alone, because there's always somebody out there that can help you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Destiny, thank you so very much for being my guest today. It's been quite the joy to get to know you, and hopefully someday we'll be at a workshop together and we'll get to meet one another in person. I'm actually going to the one that's happening this weekend. I don't know if you're planning to go to that one or not.
I'm going to the Atlanta one because I'm in
Oh, yeah. Well, that makes sense. I wanted to go someplace warm. I'm in Southern Illinois. We're supposed to get anywhere from 4 to 7 inches of snow tonight and tomorrow. And so I'm heading to Phoenix this weekend. Yeah, but totally. I'm going to have to try to get her. I'm very close to St. Louis, Missouri. So I'm going to have to try to get her to do one in St. Louis so that I don't have to travel, and I can show her around the St. Louis area a little bit. I've been with the Master IP Coach Program almost since the beginning of her doing this. So I'm a veteran. So, but I still always am learning. Because as we said, IEPs are fluid and there's always so much to learn, and society is always changing. And, you know, when I started, we had not gone into COVID. So, you know, the whole education system was turned upside down during COVID, and there's a lot of new ways to approach things with that. Mm-hmm. And so, always trying to catch the trainings and all that stuff. So anyway, thank you again for being my guest, and I wish you well, and your little boys are just going to flourish because they have you in their corner, and I so appreciate that. Next week, I will be interviewing another Master IEP coach, Diana Prowitt. She is also someone who has been at the Master IEP coach table the same amount of time as I have, I think. So that'll be another interesting topic. And I'm sorry, that's in 2 weeks, not next week. I apologize. That's February 7th. I'm getting ahead of myself. But anyway, make sure that you keep watching, subscribe, like this channel, make sure you get the notifications, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.